Welcome to We Are Technologies User Friendly with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. We're coming to you live this week from the floor of the Silicon Valley Comic Con in San Jose. Got some great interviews for you. Join us in upcoming weeks because we've got some more live from the floor coverage coming up for the Rose City Comic Con, as well as the virtual reality conference coming up in October and some other things in between. A lot of great technology and pop culture. Jeremy and Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you?
Oh, excited.
It's been great.
Yeah, it definitely has. It definitely has. And it's going to be a cool week this week. We got down here and it sounds like number one, San Jose is going to go from 100 degrees to 80. So it'll be a little easier for the costumes.
Oh, yeah.
And which is kind of nice. And what are you guys, last week on the show, you didn't know yet. What are you guys doing for the Comic-Con?
I'm wearing my Han Solo suit.
And I'm dressed as my Star Wars character that I developed myself.
Well, that's cool. So we got some good things there. And I'm sure you will put some information out on social media with some of our pictures and different things.
Oh, yeah.
That's Absolutely. Always a lot of fun. So what do you think our challenges are going to be this year?
Getting into the event, getting through the event, and actually managing to record something while we think about it.
Yeah, that's always the case, too. We're also using some new equipment, so we'll see how it sounds, hopefully well. But, yeah, getting out there. Now, one of the big differences between Silicon Valley, it's a show put on by Apple, brainchild of Steve Wozniak, who does a great show year after year with this. You have the Comic-Con components, but you also have the technology components. And we're going to have some interviews that will deal with different things from pop culture, but we're also going to be able to talk to NASA. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. What are you guys looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to NASA.
Yeah, same here.
They've had such cool displays in the last few years. I can't wait to see what they bring this year.
Yeah, I think so too. And in some of the last years, we've seen some models of distributed computing and some of the different things they use from that kind of a platform. And I'm sure this year is going to be a lot of different things. I've heard that there's a rumor that they're going to have a full-size model of the Mars rover, which will be kind of fun to see and learn all about how that works. And some of the different technologies that go along with it. And the other things that are on the floor that are really cool, the artist alley at that one's always really nice, but it isn't so huge that you can't see everything.
And yeah. They always do cool things for the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a whole kids section, a discovery area and all of that type of thing. And then there's the video games and all of that stuff too. PlayStation is going to be there, Sony with a PS4. And some different things like that. And I'm sure we're going to see a lot of cosplay, standing in line, and all of that to the end of the show.
Going to be great.
All right. Well, with that all being said, our first interview is actually already in progress. So we're going to go right now live, a little bit different than our normal format, to the floor of Silicon Valley Comic Con. Our first interview is going to talk about what's involved in cosplay and getting into the costume contest. And our guest is the director of that department for the show. So with no further ado, live to the floor, Silicon Valley Comic Con 2019.
On my events, they're people that have no clue. They have no idea they're joining a costume contest until I approach them and invite them in.
So now that's interesting. So you actually go out and invite people to come in. It's not just to sign up.
Yeah, we'll sit at the table, but we also walk around. And if we see something that catches our eye, we'll encourage them to come over to the table and sign up. Some people, you know, they do their costumes because they want to do the costume contest to see, you know, how it works. Okay. Some people, they just want to walk across the stage. They don't care if they win a prize or not. They just want people to see it. And with our venue here, it's recorded, it's shown. And so they can go home and they can review the thing and they can relive their
moment on stage.
I know personally it's been very addictive, at least in the sense once you get out there, it's just like it's one of the coolest things you can do, cosplay. And being able to show off is important. So
yesterday I had a family come up and they were all dressed. But we had reached our capacity.
Right.
But the little girl was just too cute. They had just left, just because you were coming up. And I says, go get them. They're good. I'm going to, because I'm in charge, I can make that call.
Right. Of course, yeah.
You see something special or phenomenal, I'll go over what my limits are.
Right.
And half, 9 times out of 10, you know, they might win, you know, they'll win something. But then at the next event, I'll see them come back on their own. And that's always fun. And then watching people who've been doing it for a while, and then they get pointers from the judges on how to improve or, you know, be more confident. And it's amazing to watch the transformation from event to event as they learn and they grow, and they feel more comfortable and they have fun.
Yeah,
and that's the biggest key to the costume contest, is to have fun doing it.
Yeah, I agree.
The trophies are just a little perk, you know. They're not always, you know, there. But we have fun. We get people out there. We, you know, they have fun.
I think from one of the things I've been seeing here especially is the quality of a lot of the cosplays is just through the roof. I mean,
yes.
You see some just incredible, it's like it could come off a movie screen type things.
Yes.
So yes. This is a great event all around, the mixing of the science and the arts together. Mm-hmm. And it's extra special.
So if you have someone that would like to do a costume or a cosplay, how do they get started?
Well, they look at the character. If they're going after somebody specific from a show or a comic strip or a movie, look at the character. Is it somebody they would feel comfortable making a representation of? And then, do they want to be like an exact copy of that person? Or do they want to personalize it and make it into their own? And that, you know, there is a little bit of a planning. I've had kids come in with sketchbooks of how they started before they even went to the fabric store to get fabric, or the supply store to get the foam and the other parts for creating an outfit.
I know some of the mashups, like what you're talking about, are some of the funnest things. There's one here that's one of the most unique, which I believe is Mick Thor. And it's Ronald McDonald and Thor, like from the movie.
Yes.
And
I liked the Native American Captain America.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought he was really interesting.
He was, he really surprised me. I didn't see him when he signed up, but when he went across
I'm like,
how did I miss this? Because that, again, would have been one that I would have said, hey, come on over and, you know.
Yeah, join the fun.
Come join the fun. Because people will find the unique. They will find the piece that makes it them and personalizes it into, I'm gonna make this character, I'm gonna create it, I'm gonna have fun, and I'm gonna own it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make this costume and I'm gonna own it.
I've kind of done it with my Jedi character.
Yeah.
It's a race that you only see in one episode of one of the cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like the character.
But it doesn't matter, because there's no rules on that. You do what
there's,
you like.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you may have a contest that is somewhat themed. You know, like focusing on just anime or a certain type of anime. Or, you know, we'll have... Mostly we keep it pretty much open, but we'll like do most original anime, which is like something that closest... resembles an anime show that's out there.
Right.
That's a original design that's unique. You know, and they're doing their best to represent the theme of the event.
So how do your categories work here? I know we talked a little bit about some of the different things for amateur to professional, and you had a very unique way from anything we've seen before of being able to divide that out, and it seems like something that would really give everybody the ability to jump in and participate.
Well, we have the categories for levels of creativity. We also offer best of show, best group, best portrayal of the event, and then we also have judges' choice, where our judges can pick their favorite, and then we had the audience choice award, the characters that went across that made the most impact to the audience. And their presence on stage, and they received the audience, or the two officers in the big popple boxes. You know, that those were really unique. And with the categories, the novice is if you've never been in a contest before and you haven't won anything, that's considered a novice. The next level, the intermediate journeyman, you've entered 3 to 5 contests, and you've won at least once.
Okay.
For the master, you'll need to have won at least 3 or 4 times at various events. Doesn't have to be in your level, you know. You may, and we, you know, this year we did something a little different. We had the best newcomer.
That's cool.
Somebody who had never participated before. It was their very first time making an outfit and having that energy to come up and go across the stage with their, you know, the outfit on. And, you know, it's fun watching the people go and watching them straighten up and just get that proud moment of, I got this. And it's really fun.
So any advice for next year?
For next year?
Yeah.
Don't be shy. Come sign up.
And sign up early because it does fill up.
Yes, yes, it does.
So anything else you want to tell us?
Be creative. Make something that makes you happy. And be brave enough to share it with others. Come sign up for the contest.
So something to check out for next year, definitely. And go online and check it out for this year at SVCC, #SVCC. This is User Friendly recording live at the Silicon Valley Comic Con. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. This week we are live from the Silicon Valley Comic Con, where we're about to go talk to an engineer from NASA who's going to talk about how they do software and user interfaces for not only the Mars rover, but pretty much everything they do.
So
what do we got going on here?
Okay, so this is a software called OpenMCT. It's open source. It's created at NASA. It's a joint collaboration between a team based at NASA Ames in Silicon Valley and then with the JPL down in Pasadena.
Right.
And the goal of the software is that it allows mission control and situational awareness during mission operations.
Okay.
So what that really means is, think of it like this. You've got a moon rover or a Mars rover that has literally tens of thousands of elements on it that have telemetry coming out of them and they're being sent down to the ground.
So like sensors and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yes.
Okay.
You've got a monitor. I mean, down to, in some cases, like individual resistors on circuit boards, because you have to watch their temperature and make sure that they've got the right amount of electricity flowing through them. The instruments all have telemetry, both operational and scientific telemetry that's coming back down. So
you know, that's actually a very interesting point, because if you have something that is completely remote,
Yeah. You
would have to be able to interface with it at that level to be able to deal with a problem or, you know, whatever.
If your super expensive RC car flips over...
Yeah.
You cannot go and pick it up and ride it or open up the chassis and fix something that's there. So you have to make sure nothing goes wrong.
So you design these interfaces.
Yes.
So what goes into that?
That's a really good question. Mostly we have a good understanding of just general design practices. I think
Right. That
probably goes without saying. But I think most importantly is that we work very closely with scientists and instrument specialists and people who are really the users of the software to understand how they do their jobs, understand things that they've liked and not liked about software that they've used in the past. And then we use that information when we go into the design process.
Right, right.
I also work very closely with my dev team. Our whole development team is very tightly knit, very collaborative. So we are, you know, we may do a design and like it and then actually build something. And
right.
Then once we start using it, we're like, that doesn't work so well.
Yeah.
So, okay, we use an agile workflow.
Right. Okay.
Process,
yeah. Yeah.
And so we're able to iterate very quickly. Other than that, we make clickable prototypes sometimes that we then share those with our stakeholders so we can kind of prototype interaction designs before we actually commit to building them.
Right. So your team is dealing with both hardware and software then, really?
Not so much the hardware, actually.
Okay,
I guess we deal with the hardware in the sense that We have to we have to know what the hardware is going to be sending us in terms of data, but we're not actually interfacing with it ourselves.
So would
directly.
You prototype that in a software environment to be able to get the feedback to start to build the user interface? Or
occasionally, yes. But we also there's lots of tools that allow you to create like clickable interfaces very, very quickly and rapidly that don't have a lot behind them. They're not really wired up to everything.
But
they're clickable and they feel real.
Right. So what comes first, the hardware or the software, or does it develop at the same time?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. So let's talk about, for instance, like an instrument. So there's a moon rover project called Viper at NASA that's going to be going up to the moon to look for water ice.
Okay.
We worked on a prototype version of that mission. We've been working on that actually for several years. The stuff you're seeing on the left-hand screen right here is all playback data that came out of simulation sessions where we had a rover simulator, we drove a rover around. That rover has an instrument on it called NIRVIS, which is a near-infrared spectrometer. Yeah, an interesting name choice of acronyms. It's a near-infrared something or other spectrometer. I believe, and again, this is a little outside sort of what we do, because we're just doing sort of visualization software, the telemetry. But I believe that they kind of work on the hardware itself and the flight software that runs on the hardware at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's just assumed that then the telemetry is coming off of that system. That goes into a database, and then that can be consumed and displayed by a variety of tools, including ours.
Okay, all right, cool. So that's where you get your data. So
yes.
I'm a developer myself, which is why I ask those questions, because
we
run into the same type of thing, but just nothing that's cool.
Well,
so
a thing to point out, I think, is that this is a client-side application. It's JavaScript.
Right.
It runs in the browser. It's a single-page JavaScript application. It doesn't have a database. The reason is because every mission at NASA, and we're also used by private sector folks as well. LightSail 2, for instance, is using us. They all want to do data their own way.
Right.
Yeah.
And we don't want to paint anybody into a corner with a particular database, saying you must use InfluxDB or something like that.
So you have to be able to consume information from anything.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we have a modular architecture that allows us to write adapters, and those adapters can allow this software to connect to pretty much any kind of data source you've got. As long as it's got timestamps and it's got values, then we could pretty much connect to it.
No, that is just incredible.
Yeah, thank you.
So, I mean, the design looks...
I told him what caught my attention was this had an almost Star Trek...
Yeah, it kind of does.
You know, that feeling of the Enterprise for Next Generation, and that kind of caught my attention.
And there's a thing I should point out, too. I mean, we're showing two different interfaces here. One is really quite real.
Right.
This one here is actually using the exact same software, but this is something that we did for fun. It's actually it's going to be used in a digital short film.
Okay.
A friend of our team is working on, and it is a kind of a spaceship cockpit. And it's telling part of the story of during a launch when then things go horribly wrong, and you'll see when everything starts flashing.
When it goes red and everything like that. Okay,
So, but it's using the same componentry, you know, the dials and displays and plots.
Right.
And, blinking lights and all that stuff. All that's available in the base OpenMCT as well.
Wow.
The other thing, too, about the software that's cool is, and I know your listeners can't really see this, but... not only can we assemble these displays as you see them, but users actually go and create their own displays in a WYSIWYG environment. So there's an edit mode to this screen where you can literally just drag in telemetry and place it however you like. And you can use this create button up here in the upper left to pull down, and that'll allow you to create all kinds of different data displays, basically, for the different data types that we support.
I think that's amazing. I think the flexibility is something that is really, really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, that's one of our primary goals.
Yeah.
Is a lot of times these sorts of tools are a black box to their users.
Right.
They're like a something that's been done by a coder, and it's a black. It's just trying to see what's inside of it is really hard. If that person who made it goes away, goes on to another project.
Exactly, yeah.
Trying to figure out what they did
and
then how to fix it if they need to, or how to change it, is really difficult. And also, if you're a user, and I'm like, well, no, I'm an instrument specialist, and this big overview screen you gave me isn't giving me 80% of what
right.
I need.
Right.
And then it's, you know, it's, but in our world, the user can go in, create a blank canvas, drag in all the elements they want, place them, size them, say, I want a table here, a plot here, et cetera, et cetera. Save that, and then that's a savable thing that they can use or they can share with other users in the system
right.
as well.
Too cool.
Yeah.
Well, this is absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for letting us know about it.
Hey, my pleasure.
Your name is?
Oh, I'm Charles Haskalow.
Okay, because I was looking at your name going.
Charles Haskalow. Okay, I was going to ask you before I tried to pronounce it.
That's a tough one. I'm with the OpenMCT group at Ames in Silicon Valley.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break. This is User Friendly 2.0 live from the Silicon Valley Comic Con in San Jose. We're going to go to the floor where we're going to be talking to NASA about the Mars rover and about some other things having to do with all the movies we've seen where a satellite blows up and takes all the rest out. Is that a real thing? Let's find out. And we are here at a display from NASA where we're looking at the Mars rover. Now, I know you and I talked a little bit before the show, and this is about the size of a car, and maybe we could start with a little bit of the background and how this got so big.
So our Mars rover started small, right? We started back in the late 90s with a little rover called Sojourner. You may have seen Bart Simpson using it as a skateboard in the Simpsons once, right? And it was like an engineering test, but we learned a whole bunch. And in fact, the suspension system from that tiny little rover back in the 90s is identical to the suspension system we now use, you know, 20 plus years later, on a rover that weighs 2,000 pounds and is about the size of a Mini Cooper.
So is it really the original suspension? Did you make it bigger to adjust to the size?
It's a lot bigger.
Right.
In fact, the wheels are exactly 4 times bigger. But as a design, it's essentially scaled up.
Now that is really cool. And the other thing I know you were telling me about a little bit is how this is all powered.
Yeah, so between Sojourner and this big Curiosity rover, we had two rovers called Spirit and Opportunity. And they were both solar powered. And every winter, we would have to find north-facing slopes to camp on to survive through the cold winter. And when dust storms came, we'd be really nervous. And in fact, it was a dust storm that killed the Opportunity rover last year.
That actually took it out.
Yeah.
Finally,
this rover survived that dust storm and genuinely didn't care.
Right.
Right. Because we're not solar-powered. We use what's known as an RTG, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. It uses plutonium, not as like a nuclear reactor, just a natural decay of plutonium-238 that puts out a whole bunch of heat.
Okay.
And we have the hot rock in the middle, we have fins that are exposed to the cold air on the outside, and that gradient of temperature is enough to generate about 85 watts of electricity. Use something called the thermoelectric effect.
Right.
Right. Now, those 85 watts aren't enough to run the rover all on its own, and so inside the rover, we also have a big lithium battery, and we use the RTG kind of like a trickle charger. So we'll wake the rover up in the morning, we'll be awake for 4 to 6 hours, depending on what we're actually doing. Then we'll go to sleep, we're trickle charging the battery, wake up again, do a communications pass, take another nap, right? And so the rover, you know, much like a cat, spends most of its life napping and recharging, right?
Yes. An idea that I actually totally can support, but
I was listening to the part where you said that the dust storm took out one of the rovers. Okay, so I have like a stupid idea. Can you send one of these up with like a little brush to clean off the
So it's like why didn't you have something to clean them, right?
Yeah.
Right. So the problem. So that mission opportunity, mm-hmm. the requirement was for it to last 90 days. At 14 years,
yes.
a dust storm took it out, right?
Yeah,
so it did fine, right? but you could say, you know what, windshield wipers, or get the solar panels and rattle them around,
mm-hmm.
or like film on the front you can wind across.
Right.
All of those cost, and it's not only the money, it's the weight, it's the power they need. It's the complexity and the risks they bring with them. What if your windshield wiper got stuck in the middle, or it was just scratching the glass and making it even worse,
yeah.
right? And so better is the enemy of good enough, right? We got our 90 days and a little bit more.
Yeah,
right?
Just a touch. You got longer
another,
than my car.
Another so. 5,100 and some odd days. But there's also the, could you go and fix it? Well, if you want to go and fix it, you'd be sending another rover that's now 15, 20 years newer. Mm-hmm. That rover's going to be way more capable than that old one.
Right.
So why not just send the new rover?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it seems like there just is a lifespan, and that's what you're dealing with.
Curiosity was designed to last 2 years. We're at 7 years. In fact, today it is sold 2,500 of our mission. And she's still going great.
Right.
And we're getting better at operating her every single year. We're getting more efficient. We're understanding exactly how much power everything takes a bit more accurately. We're getting a little braver when it comes to dipping into that battery. And so we could get another 7 years out of her, no problem at all.
Now, you were talking a little bit about the communications pass. How do you get the information back, and how does that work?
So the one problem we can't get over is the speed of light, right? It doesn't matter what we do. It's still going to take something between 5 or 22-ish minutes for a signal to get from Earth to Mars,
right,
and from Mars back to Earth again. And we'd love to sit at our desk with a joystick and drive this thing around and point the cameras and zap the rocks, but we can't do that. And so what we do is when the rover wakes up in the morning, we send commands directly from the Earth straight to the rover.
Right.
It's got a small antenna that it can point at the Earth to receive those instructions. And it takes about 20 minutes or so for basically us to send it a big email saying, hey, here's what we want you to do today.
Right.
And that has a read receipt on it. And the read receipt is it turns its radio back on for 5 minutes, goes beep, and we go, great, it heard us. It's now using these new commands. The first command is turn your radio on for 5 minutes. Right. And so that's called the beep. Then the rover goes about and does its thing. It might be driving. It might be using the cameras and the laser spectrometer. It might be getting the robotic arm out to look at some rocks. It might be using the labs inside the rover with samples it's already got. But then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one of our Mars orbiters will fly overhead. And they're not just useful for science. We use them as relay satellites. Right. And so for about 12 minutes or so, we use a different antenna. And we can dump a huge amount of data up to the orbiter in one go. And then it's the orbiter's job to send it home because it's got big solar panels and a massive radio dish. And so in terms of kind of efficiency of getting data home, it's way, way better than us trying to trickle it home ourselves through a small antenna.
Okay, so you actually have two methodologies then really in place to be able to communicate.
Yes, yeah.
And the one would be just like a communication satellite we use here.
Yes.
So that's cool. So tell us a little bit about the experiments. I know you've got all kinds of sensors. We were talking about that a little bit.
Yeah. So the stuff we use all the time, just while we're trundling around, we've got weather sensors, we've got a radiation sensor that can tell us how harmful Mars is for astronauts in the future. Right. We've got something called DAN that measures the hydrogen abundance in the upper few meters of soil. That can tell us how much water there might be locked up in the minerals. And then we've got color cameras up on the mast, we've got the laser spectrometer up on the mast. But the real reason Curiosity is so darn big is a big couple of instruments inside called SAM and KEMIN. SAM really imaginatively stands for Sample Analysis at Mars. KEMIN stands for Chemistry and Mineralogy. SAM is a suite of mass spectrometers. Typically, they're the sort of instruments that would take up an entire laboratory on Earth. We shrunk it down to something the size of a small refrigerator, and it takes up like the front third of the rover. KEMIN is an X-ray diffraction spectrometer. We can use that to identify different mineralogy. So typically, we will have a look around. We'll have a strategic plan in mind of something we've seen from orbit that we want to go look at. We drive there, we get there, we get the robotic arm out, we look at the rocks up close, we figure out, can we drill this? Is it safe for drilling? We'll actually stab it with the end of the drill, see if it moves, right? If we're all happy, we'll then drill it. We'll take a bit of the sample from the drill, not much more than like a baby aspirin size of drill tailings, and drop it into KEMIN first.
Right.
KEMIN will run an experiment overnight to figure out what the mineralogy is. If it looks kind of interesting, we'll then drop more sample into SAM, and then SAM can do a number of different experiments over a few days to really break down, like down to the molecule level of what's inside this sample. And as a result, we've found like evidence that where we landed was once a dry riverbed, like there was a river flowing there. Now it's just dry rock, but there was water flowing between ankle and waist deep that was so fresh you could have drunk it.
Jeez.
And since then, we've actually found organic compounds, not like...
Really?
Yeah, not like life, but the building blocks thereof. Everything that life would need, we have found. And we've also found that once there was a habitat that would have supported it as well.
So the idea that there could have been life on Mars is actually something that could be pretty real.
Yeah, we don't know if it did.
Right.
But there's absolutely no reason why it couldn't. We found all the signs that it absolutely could have done.
So what's the most interesting mineral that you've found, or most exciting?
So for me, it's the story ahead of where we are right now. So we've mapped some of the minerals from orbit. Mm-hmm. That's finding the interesting minerals is kind of why we went to where we are, a place called Gale Crater. It's kind of the size of the Central Valley. It's about 100 miles across, but in the middle is a mountain the size of Mount Whitney, right? And we landed between the mountain and the edge of the crater, and we're now in the foothills of that mountain. Now, we're in a region at the moment where we have clay minerals. They're called phyllosilicates. That's what our geologists call them. Mm-hmm. They can only form in the presence of neutral pH water.
Wow, okay.
If it's acidic or alkali, they don't form. Okay. Ahead of us, up in the foothills, another couple of miles away, the clays go away, and they're covered over by sulfates. Different kind of mineral, can only form in the presence of acidic water. Now, the third era of geology we see ahead of us beyond that is a different kind of sulfate that typically does sand dunes blowing around, right, and eventually cementing in place. And those three things are the three kind of eras of Martian geology. Neutral pH, water, a habitable environment. Suddenly that becomes acidic and pretty ugly for some reason, and then suddenly it's gone away. And that story is one we can read chapter by chapter as we go from the clay unit to the sulfate unit and beyond. And we've been doing the clay unit for about a year or two. We've got some really juicy stuff coming up ahead. We're just entering what's called Extended Mission 3. It's the next 3 years of our mission. And we're going to be in that time making that transition from the clay unit to the sulfate unit. And it's like the cliffhanger at the end of a book, and we know the next book is just over the next hill.
That makes this a really, just a cool thing to be able to do, and you know something you got coming up that's going to be really exciting.
It's a legitimate adventure. Like, curiosity is the frontier of human exploration, and it has human-like vision, right? We operate it like a little, it's a robot that goes around and does our bidding for us. It is the kind of the forefront of the human experience is through robots like Curiosity.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we'll have to do a follow-up someday.
Absolutely. Yeah. And hey, I want to ask you, if it's okay, one other question. It's a little different direction, but it's one that's come in from our listeners a lot. And we talked about the communication satellites and stuff. And you know all this stuff you see in a movie where something breaks up and it breaks everything else up?
Yeah.
Is that a real thing?
It's called the Kessler effect,
right?
Of one satellite hits another satellite, you suddenly got a big debris cloud that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and hits other things.
Right.
So that is potentially a real thing.
Okay, so that actually is a concern.
So,
then.
Yeah, and on a couple of occasions, countries have intentionally smacked into a spacecraft,
wow,
made a debris field. America did it some years ago. We had a dead satellite in low Earth orbit that had some big metallic components and a big tank of hydrazine. It was frozen solid. Hydrazine's not nice stuff.
Right.
And so the DOD went, we're going to knock it out of the sky. We're going to blow it to smithereens so it doesn't come down in one lump. And it was very low orbit. And so when they smacked it, it only took a couple of days, the rest of it just to come down, because it's just grazing the top of the atmosphere,
right,
and it slowly re-enters. Sometimes it's by accident.
Right.
We've had like an old satellite get hit by a current functioning satellite, and suddenly you've got a huge debris field. It is not out of the question that debris field, a piece of it would hit another one and then cause another thing like that. That kind of knock-on effect hasn't happened yet, but we have many companies right now proposing constellations of communication satellites,
yeah,
with 1,000, 3,000, 5,000 satellites in them, and that increases the likelihood of that effect actually happening.
So that does seem like a little bit of a scary thing.
Yeah, it's a whole new meaning
to
air pollution.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a legitimate concern.
Do you think it would eventually fall out of orbit, or would it be there for...
So stuff in low Earth orbit eventually comes down anyway. If you,
right,
if you throw something out from the International Space Station, in about 6 months to a couple of years, it re-enters, right?
Okay.
But you're only about 400 kilometers up.
Right.
As you get higher, it takes longer. And once you're at like 1,000 kilometers or more, where actually quite a lot of science satellites live, that's like 50 years plus before it comes back down again. Stuff beyond that, it could take a really long time, like centuries. Some of these new kind of communication constellations are actually designed so they can, when the satellite's getting old, it's like, I'm now going to dump myself back into the atmosphere and burn up. But if you think about it, if it's working, why would you get rid of it? It's making you money.
True.
Right? So. How lucky are you to throw away a perfectly functioning spacecraft? And so it's something they're going to have to look at.
Yeah.
And, you know, one solution is maybe the spacecraft are aware of one another and try and avoid each other if that's going to happen.
Right.
The Department of Defense has a wing dedicated to tracking everything in orbit. And all that data is online. So we can, you know, every now and again, the International Space Station will get a heads up, say, hey, we're going to do a little boost because otherwise we're going to hit a thing.
Right.
And if it's going to be like a near miss, we don't get much heads up, like an hour or two, they actually get in one of their capsules they could come home in and close the door and sit there till it's gone past.
Oh boy.
Right? Yeah, I'd be biting my fingernails
with
that, I think. You know, it just,
yeah. And then when the risk's gone, you know, normally it's like, oh, it missed by 400 meters, right? Wow. It's not a long way when you're doing 17,500 miles an hour.
Well, listen, thank you so much. It's going to be absolutely incredible to have this.
Absolute pleasure.
This is User Friendly 2.0. We'll be back after the break with a wrap of the show. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. Check out our pictures from this week's show. One User Friendly on Facebook, one User Friendly on Twitter. We're going to be posting everything out there. A lot of the different things that we saw, pictures of the booths, pictures of the exhibits, and most importantly, pictures of the cosplays. And there were some really good ones this year. Send us what you want us to talk about. Send us your questions. Our show's number is 503-766-6264. And the way that works is when you call in, you'll get an AI that will take your information. And from that, we put our topics together. The other way to get to us is through our website, userfriendlyshow.com or theanswerportland.com. So, Jeremy Gretchen, what did you think of this year's Silicon Valley?
I really enjoyed the NASA stuff. I really enjoyed all the comic stuff, all the vendors, all the things you could see and do and understand that, you know, weren't there last year.
Yeah, they had a nice variety again. It was just awesome.
I think the virtual reality coming into its own on the PlayStation is kind of cool. Being able to see where they're going with that and actually having that kind of money behind developing things is amazing. I still like my Oculus Rift. I play with it all the time, but I think maybe after seeing what they're doing and where that's going, we need to get the PS4 headset and start playing with that a little bit too.
Yeah, I kind of wish that I'd been able to try it out, but when you're wearing a full face makeup, you just don't want to get it all over their gear. I would feel really bad.
But yeah, I know it's a big part of it. Hey, a shout out this year to Heroic Imaging. I think your guys' pictures came out really cool.
They were awesome.
Thank you.
So doing the cosplay was interesting this year. I mean, we had the makeup and all of the different things that go along with that as we normally do. And Gretchen, I know you and I have a lot more of that. And Jeremy, you kind of get away without it, which seems like a good thing and a bad thing. But I don't know. It takes a lot, I think, to put all of this together. And Gretchen, getting dressed for you in that costume is not an easy thing, is it?
No. And I actually, it's not the costume itself. It's the makeup. Yeah. I'm not a makeup expert. And we even had some difficulties with your costume makeup because you forgot yours. And we had to try and remember what it was that we purchased. And then we couldn't find some of the components. One of my own pieces of makeup is like a stick, like a pencil, really fat pencil. And I couldn't find a way to
sharpen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the details of being on the road. And, you know, I'm kind of glad the piece that I did forget was something that we could replace, because you couldn't replace a robe or a sewn part of it or something, you know. So there are some things with this. I know one of my first things was when we put my Wookiee together and that first time we used it and the glue was so sharp in it. Oh, boy, I'm not sure I've sobered up from that yet. But
anyway. Oh, yeah, it needs to stick.
But, you know, all of these things are things to think about. And like we heard earlier with the costume contest, it's just do the best you can. You got to get started somewhere and kind of just build your way on up from there.
Exactly.
So this is User Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User Friendly 2.0 is copyright 2019 User Friendly Media Group, Inc. The views and opinions expressed in this show are those of the host and not necessarily User Friendly Media Group, Inc. or the station. Music licensing by BMI. Hosting provided by WeAreTechnology.com. Podcast available at TheAnswerPortland.com or UserFriendlyShow.com.